It is 24 and a bit to 10 here on RNZ National. And that means it's time for Midweek Media Watch with the notorious Hayden Donnell, who joins me now in studio. Hayden, kia ora to you.
Kia ora, Emil.
Where should we start this week? Well, the biggest media news story of the week is probably the Herald being subject to complaints after running a front page advert, a wraparound advert from Hobson's Pledge. And there was an update on this on Monday evening.
Yeah, just to recap for anyone that isn't across this one, the Herald ran a wraparound front page ad from Hobson's Pledge, which basically claimed Māori were laying claim to pretty much all our foreshore. Now, that provoked a huge reaction, foremost from Māori journalists and media professionals, but also from many, many others. Hobson's Pledge decided to run an ad responding to these critics. So it was going to run another wraparound Herald ad. It was broken by the media insider Shane Curry on, I think, Monday evening that the Herald will not be running that ad following the backlash. And now Don Brash has responded to that again, accusing the Herald of caving in to what he calls the cancel mob of Te Pāti Māori activists.
Don Brash, who's involved with Hobson's Pledge?
Don Brash is in. What is his position at Hobson's?
I'm not entirely sure.
The chair. He is a principal player at Hobson's Pledge, and he says that he's the victim of a double standard. Claims the Herald would have run strongly opinionated ads from his opponents.
Right. So, to take that point, and I know that you explored this on Media Watch last week, but what do you think? Is there a double standard at play here? Because the Herald has accepted controversial ads in the past.
Yeah, notably that CTU ad before the election last year, you might remember it, about Chris Lux, and it called him out of touch, too much risk, that kind of thing. That was at a pretty sensitive time, and it was a pretty controversial ad. And look, I'm relatively sympathetic to the idea that yes, it has been open to running controversial ads in the past. Then there's a question of what's different here, which we can get into later. But there's also the fact that advertising is meant to be separate from editorial. Yeah. You can take a looser line on it. You can't apply all the same standards that you would to your editorial to the advertising, because you probably wouldn't make a lot of money. And there's probably a few red lines that you'll draw, but also it doesn't have to be as stringently checked and as strongly principled as your editorial stuff generally. There's a couple of points to be made to rebut this. And the first is just kind of a style one. This Hobson's Pledge ad, what was so weird about it was that it really looked like a front page. Did you see it?
Yeah, it's wraparound ads oftentimes, well, they do, right? They're a separate page that wraps around the actual paper itself. And it's got the Herald logo on it.
It's got the Herald masthead up the top with all of the pointers to their inside stories. Yeah. And so, and what was different about this one as opposed to a Harvey Norman one was really that it actually had written content and it looked a bit like something that they might put on the front page in a special circumstance, as opposed to something selling, you know, office furniture. And so it might have been a little bit more confusing. Maybe I should give people more respect and give them more.
Maybe you should give people
they
more
can
respect.
Understand that they can understand what an ad is and what isn't, but that does cause some concern. There's more serious stuff as well, which is that several legal academics, more than 100 now, I think, have said that the ad contains major factual errors. And there's a few of them. You can look it up. It's Māori academics, legal academics. The ads calls, the original ad calls for the restoration of the foreshore to public ownership. Now, these academics would point out that the foreshore has never historically been in public ownership. It's owned by nobody in most cases, or in some cases it's in private ownership, and most of that isn't by Māori. So, yeah.
That's interesting.
So there's a whole list of things as well. I won't go into all of them.
But claims of factual errors. Is that, this is interesting. Is that something that the Herald, as publisher of the paper and therefore the ad, should have checked, do you think, before going to publication?
It's often things don't go through serious, rigorous factual checks, even in places like the opinion section, which I think is wrong. But in this case, you know this is going to be a controversial ad. You know it's going to cause a huge reaction. Yes, you should probably go over all of the fact claims in it and try and err on the side of caution. you'd think, and say, look, if there's something that is going to be seriously in dispute, maybe you want to put rein that in a little bit. I would say, just for my own reputation as a paper, I actually don't know what the advertising standards are on that. But there are standards that say you're not allowed to mislead people in advertising. It is an industry body. So maybe someone else can illuminate me on that sort of stuff.
Well, they're not going to be ringing up Harvey Norman and double checking the sale prices, are they?
Yeah. Well, maybe they are. Maybe they are. Look, some people have a lot more time than you or I even, Emil. And there is precedent, to be fair, of the Herald and other media outlets rejecting ads in the past. This isn't just a free-for-all. Yeah, okay. There was a Family First ad a while ago that was targeting trans people. Now the Herald rejected that. The ODG did too. Lots of other media did. So there are standards here. And if you fall short of them, then your ads do get rejected. So obviously they made a different call here, originally at least.
All of this was, as you say, probably quite predictable. Well, I don't know, maybe not. Maybe this has taken the Herald by surprise, I'm not sure. But it does speak the question of why the first ad was accepted when the second one has not been accepted.
I find it surprising if it's taken them by surprise. And that is a really good question, Emil, and one that I don't have a real answer to, because it seems I've managed to annoy everyone here, right? They've annoyed everyone by running it in the first place and then annoyed the people that actually support the ad by not taking the second one. So, I mean, generously, you could say that perhaps they're drawing the line at Hobson's Pledge, purposely adding fuel to the fire here, because the second ad that they were going to run was explicitly pitched as a rebuttal to its critics of the first ad. So you could say that it was purposely leveraging the controversy from that first ad to draw attention to the second. It is advocacy advertising. It is drawing attention to a Hobson's Pledge campaign. Now, it just maybe, though, I don't know whether that's the case. It just seems possible that there just wasn't enough thought that went into the first decision, to be honest.
I wanted to ask you this. Like, in the round, sort of stepping back from this specific case, I enjoyed Sunday's Media Watch. I think Colin interviewed Carmen Parahi, who oversaw Stuff's Potiaki for several years. And Carmen basically saying there is a place for advocacy ads, but that wraparound front page is the problem. And the idea that it might be a blurring of advertising and editorial, or it might be seen as that. Is that the problem from your point of view, the idea that you can essentially sell what looks to be the front page of the paper? You're getting a lot of money for this, though, and we hear a lot about, you know,
there's context as well, because it really harks back to I'm ancient, I sort of remember it, the foreshore and seabed debate in the early 2000s, and that is it's a really probably traumatic memory for many Māori then, and the Herald had a role in its coverage of that debate then, and so that context is there. For me, yeah, it's a bit confusing that it looks like the front page. That's not a problem. It's isolated to just this ad. I think the factual inaccuracies, or that to me, that if you're really going to be out there on a very controversial issue, then you should be really careful with the facts. And if that is proven, then that to me is the bigger problem.
Interesting stuff. This story, I imagine, has more legs in it. Let's move on, though. You wanted to highlight something that you thought has been missing from the wider narrative around benefit sanctions, which has really taken off this week. Yes, you feel like something's been missing, or at least lacking in the big debate.
There's a question that always comes up when we talk about benefit sanctions and benefit stuff like this, and it's the context of it, and it's often missing from the media coverage. And thankfully, though, Emil, we have our wonderful listeners and our wonderful listener feedback at Morning Report, and they raise the question that I always want to raise. So here it is.
It's hypocritical for the Prime Minister to engineer an economy with a higher unemployment rate and then blame and punish people for being unemployed.
Yeah, the Simon says, I've recently been made redundant again at 54 years old. It saddens me that our chosen economic system requires job losses and recession to drive down inflation. Clearly, we need to find a better way.
Look, thank you, Simon. It's Al. And the question, I mean, aren't our unemployed people our inflation-busting heroes? We've had Sharon Zolner and all these bank economists on the on the radio and print, they're all saying that unemployment needs to come up to bring down inflation. Unemployment's gone up to bring down inflation, and now we're sort of painting unemployment as a moral failing. Is that a little bit of a contradiction in terms? It wasn't just The Economist, though. This was also Chris Luxon, though admittedly in slightly opaque terms. Here he is on Q&A in November 2022.
We all agree this. I know, but is unemployment at its current rate sustainable?
Look, I think it's not sustainable because I think we've actually got an economy that's overheated and we've got a lot of job shortages, as you've seen, a lot of vacancies across the sectors, across different parts of
New Zealand. How high does it have to go?
Now, it's worth noting that he did quickly hedge there and say that he doesn't want anyone to lose their jobs and we need to increase immigration, that sort of thing. But it is kind of hard to square that circle, to be honest. It seems that if the unemployment rate is unsustainable at its current level, then it kind of needs to go up.
Mm. And case in point, this stuff headline today, is the economy sick enough for a rate cut?
Well, that's exactly right. And this is what Adrian Orr has said, that he's engineering a recession, more joblessness so that we can bring inflation under control and cut rates again. Is the economy sick enough? And that's it. And at the same time, we're having this debate about why aren't people in jobs? Well, is it partly because we've turfed them out of them on purpose?
From a media coverage perspective of this, and particularly with regard to our political journalists, how have you assessed how the gallery in particular has covered this wider issue?
Well, for me, it's just that it feels like a bit of missing context when we just focus on this issue in isolation and we don't talk about that wider effort that we're doing to bring down inflation. Look, I think there is a slight conflict in portraying unemployment as both a moral failing and an economy sustaining necessity, and that does sometimes get lost a bit in the day-to-day debate and drama of the political coverage. And I don't want to criticize anyone here. I've got a tough job, our political journalist, but I guess if I did have my way, we would be zooming out a little bit more and analyzing these policies in their context and that kind of systemic point of view.
We've seen a lot of a turn of phrase this week. Tough love.
Tough love, yeah. So a couple of examples of that. This is One News.
The government today announcing some tough love.
This is Morning Report.
The government is defending its tough love approach for beneficiaries not meeting their obligations.
Oh, God, I shudder at the term.
You don't like tough love?
I don't love tough love. The notorious Hayden Donnell, as you call me, does not love tough love.
Why not? Does it feel overly colloquial, condescending?
I think it does it give you the
I know what you mean,
ick?
Yeah. Tough, it feels a little
I think
bit.
It is that, it might be that it's condescending. Where does it come from? I think it comes from parenting, right?
Yeah, right.
So
yeah.
Maybe it's patronising, is it infantilising?
Well,
it's kind of a parenting term for people that are adult people,
yeah,
on benefits.
Right, your kid wants to stay up for an extra 10 minutes, but you put them to bed.
Yeah, it's tough
it's a
love.
Bit of tough love
that,
when
so
benefit
that.
Sanctions is a thing that is going to, yeah, I understand what you're saying there.
But I find it a little bit weird when the media adopts it, because it is, of course, the preferred PR framing for it. I wonder whether a neutral term
well,
might
it's catchy.
Be better here.
It's catchy, isn't it? That's the
yeah,
phrase tough
what
love
does
is
that
catchy.
Say? And, like that, yeah. You would not speak in those terms about a group that has more power in society, I think. In the media. Anyway, I don't know. Maybe they would you speak? We need to give some tough love to these.
I don't know. Tough love for landlords.
Tough love for landlords.
I don't know that that's necessarily a class dependent thing. Maybe it's just a
maybe
talking to adults kind of thing.
Yeah.
And using the phrase tough love as you suggested before. Anyway, look. I suppose that's neither here nor there. But gotcha questions also got caught up in this wider discourse, Hayden.
There was a little bit of a gotcha from Ingrid Hipkiss to Chris Luxon on Morning Report.
Well, hopefully our listeners that you are referring to are not having to get by on that job seeker benefit. Do you know how much that is?
No, I don't, but not right now. But I just would say to you, it's about making sure we get people prepared for work, and we think off welfare and into work is a much better outcome for individuals and their families.
So you don't know how much someone who is on a job seeker benefit is having to live on?
I'll give you a precise number, but I don't know the precise number.
Now, these sorts of questions have been controversial in the past, right? You probably remember the Green Party leader, Adam Bandt, over in Australia, famously responding, "Google it, mate," when he was asked for an obscure economic number. In this case, would you call it a gotcha? Is it an allowable gotcha? I kind of think it probably is, because when you're reducing the amount that someone's making on a benefit, and it probably seems pretty pertinent to have that information at hand, the exact amount that they're getting right now if you're going to cut it, right?
I would think so. And also Adam Bandt, I think that his response came in the throes of, it had sort of caught on in Australian media, the idea of standing up in the middle of a press conference and saying, how much is 3 litres of milk in Northern Territories? And this had happened several times, and politicians had answered it wrong, and a great fund was had at their expense for being completely out of touch, when if you're making an announcement about benefit sanctions, it surely is reasonable to expect a prime minister to know how much
the benefit currently is if you're going to be cutting it. It's very relevant to the actual content of the policy at hand, and maybe that's where you draw the line. It has to be relevant to what you're actually talking about. You can't just ask, what is the price of cheese? Though we often do that.
We often do that too, yeah.
Yeah, what's cheese? And maybe that's fine too, because it's kind of, are you in touch with the people?
Well, it happens in electoral debates, doesn't it? That there is sort of like a list of things. How much is a block of cheese? How much is a leg of lamb? And so on and so forth. And you can imagine the swatting up for that in the debate. In the war.
Yeah. Politicians, if you have prepared for a debate, did you actually have to memorise a whole bunch of supermarket prices?
It's a banana, Michael. Staples. How much could it be? $10?
Yeah. You don't want to seem like that guy. Chris Hipkins gave a great answer to that one, actually. He really does seem to do the supermarket shopping.
Let's talk about the emergency housing waitlist. A really, really substantial drop in the number of people living in emergency houses.
32%, the government said it's gone down, the number of people living in emergency housing. This was a press release put out on Sunday by Tama Pōtaka, Associate Housing Minister. He says that's 1,000 kids no longer in emergency housing. And that press release got the headline that the government wanted from the Waikato Times. It said 1,000 fewer children in emergency accommodation, Associate Housing Minister reveals, or in the Post it was even shorter, 1,000 fewer children in emergency accommodation. Now, according to the Times story, 30% of those children are now in private housing, 50% are in some form of social housing.
But the dramatic nature of those numbers has raised some eyebrows.
Yes, there's lots of questions over this. The first that you'd have to ask is, what about the other 20%? Because I think 30 and 50, now I'm not a maths genius. I think that adds up to 80. So where are the other 200 children? I do want to know that, actually. The Herald, on its Tuesday edition and its editorial, it deserves credit for taking a stab at answering that question. Now, under the headline, "Not even Houdini could make that many families disappear from the list," it begins, "Beware of Friday afternoon and Sunday morning government press releases. They are dispatched to either hide a story over the weekend, when most people tend to switch off and make claims that they will have, that will take time to check."
It's a good rule of thumb, actually.
Yes, it's good advice. I think that's right from the Herald. Now, it links the stats with new rules that limit people's eligibility for emergency housing, and says it suspects the drop is partly down to, I guess, more families getting kicked out or not accessing that housing in the first place. Now, RNZ's story, also of note, just contains traces of journalistic digging rather than stenography, unlike some others. And Ryan Bridge, Newstalk ZB, he was pretty critical as well.
They said they'd used, quote, intensive work to cut the numbers. I don't know whether I'm just cynical, but do you believe that? Or do you think there's some tricks of, some fudging of the numbers here?
Also some more compliments for Herald editorial writing on Media Watch.
Yeah, exactly. Look, we don't hate the Herald editorial. Don't stop writing them, guys. Maybe just ease up on the AI. The humans do a better job, I think.
Let's talk quickly with 4 and a bit minutes left.
Can I make one extra point on this, Emil? Because I like to rant.
By all means.
But houses do take a little while to build, last time I checked. And I just do wonder if any of the journalists can check exactly how many of these houses that people have moved into were sort of built and consented during the current term of government. Because I have a feeling that it might be very few, perhaps even less than one. Now, that's a question that I'd like to ask as well. Sorry, let's go on.
All right. Let's talk a bit about rugby, because it has not just been the government getting mixed up in PR dark arts. You wanted to call out the All Blacks. Launch a stinging broadside.
Cynical stuff. Getting beaten by Argentina right before we won 3 gold medals in a night buries the bad news under all this tsunami of good news. And I want to write this just as cynical as the government putting out a press release on a Sunday or a Friday or whatever. And I want to right some wrongs and just say, look, they played awfully, didn't they, Emil? It was awful. Did you see it?
Well, yes, I did. I watched the whole game.
It was just awful.
I mean, the All Blacks didn't play well. I like to see Argentina do well, though.
Yeah, well, you're a magnanimous kind of guy like that, and I just don't have that kind of psyche.
I think it does shape up well the narrative arc for Scott Robertson's time in charge of the All Blacks. Do you know what I mean?
Well, he starts out losing.
It starts out sort of middling in those tests against England and then losing to the Pumas in Wellington with lots of empty seats in the crowd, although RNZ's Jamie Wall is on the warpath.
The moral arc of the All Blacks is long and bends towards glory.
Yeah, well, exactly. Stretching up towards glory like a sunflower. And Scott Robertson
I didn't intend for this to be a positive segment. Well, maybe the All Blacks deserve their time in the opposite of the sun, the withering glare of the media watch spotlight.
Mariana's Trench, yeah.
And they need to, though you got saved by Lisa Carrington, Hamish Kerr, and it's not right.
Just quickly as well, on that topic of sport, you wanted to point out the Herald ran what you might describe as a relatively iffy story about Iman Khalif.
Yeah, it wasn't their story. It was through a content sharing agreement they have with the Telegraph, but the Daily Telegraph in the UK. It was a very iffy story. The main thing is that it just boldly calls Iman Khalif a biological male. Yeah. Now, that's a pretty sketchy allegation. It may or may not. The IBA is a Russian-led organization currently suspended from Olympic competition on corruption allegations. Now, it's alleged that Khalif has XY chromosomes or that she has raised testosterone, but the results of those tests that it carried out are very murky. They haven't been released. It's also worth noting that women with XY chromosomes have given birth. So just to state, just boldly, that she's a biological male, I think is pretty confident and I would say wrong for the Telegraph to do that.
Certainly.
And it was republished by the Herald.
Yeah, yes, exactly. The Telegraph taking a big risk with that.
Well, particularly given legal action seems to have been launched against people like Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling.
Indeed, yeah.
By Iman Khalif and her representatives over some of their comments. And it would be worth noting as well that this story has been pulled down.
Very finally, Hayden, with about a minute left, a small piece of media news. The platform is going analog.
Yeah, Sean Plunkett, Michael Law's shows from the platform will be broadcast on Radio Aotearoa frequencies in places like Tauranga, Hawke's Bay, Pukekohe, Hamilton, Manukau. Look, yeah, it's a digital platform, the platform, and it's now going analog.
But
analog.
Indeed, yes, still
it's an addition.
Digital radio as well. But the platform has long touted the fact that because it is digital only, the broadcasting standards don't apply.
They've taken some glee in that.
Yeah.
And the BSA is a legislation. All the radio broadcasters come under it just automatically. Yeah. So this will open them up to BSA complaints. Now, those complaints won't come to the platform. They'll come to Radio Aotearoa. But it does mean that you can now, I guess, complain about the platform's content in some sort of official channel.